Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo, Aaron Alvarado, and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Look who's back. We've had a break.
Oh, man. Incredible. Too long. It has been way, way, way too long.
It has been far too long. We apologize to those who have been waiting for us to drop an episode for the past month. But Aaron and I have been a little busy.
Oh, yeah. Both of us separately. Let's get that straight right off the bat. We don't want anything implied.
I was going to say we moved into a new house. And when I said we, I mean you and I both, but not the same house. You moved to your own new house and I moved to my own new house.
Let's be clear, I moved into a new apartment, not a new house.
Whatever. You know, it's like some people call apartments houses, almost like you'd use the word home, you know?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like in Utah. This is something I learned when I first moved there, is people will call movies shows. Like, that was a good show. Yeah, it's a really weird thing. I know. A lot of people
do it.
And I never got over it. In fact, I continued to correct people in the most just jerky, condescending way. People are like, oh, what'd you think about that show on Friday? You know, like we'll have like a company movie or whatever, like, you know, and someone at work on Monday, what'd you think about that show on Friday? I was like, show? Was there a new TV show that came out on Friday? And I'll just act dumb until I make them say movie or film or something.
You shame them into calling it a movie. Do you, what was I going to say? How are your neighbors? How's the new neighborhood that you're in?
It's good. We live... I love telling people this. We live in a gated community.
Oh, no.
So we're renting a house. We're renting a house. We hope to buy in the next 12 months, but we wanted to get into a house so we could like kind of really do our due diligence and research into finding a house in California. Not the cheapest place to buy a home, mind you. Very, very expensive. But we were looking for a house to rent in one of the more affluent suburbs of Sacramento, and they are not cheap, and we were hoping to find one right in this price range, and we did, and it was in a good neighborhood, but like in the inside, it's just nothing is updated, right? I mean, it is 1992, but it happens to be in a really, really nice neighborhood with other nice houses, but it is like Whoville, where the homes are so close together, and they're stacked in this way like Tetris. To where, like, I open my front door and I just see the side of my neighbor's house right in front of me. And I have about 3 feet of space to walk down to my garage on the left. And so it's like this really, really tightly packed area. But it's got a gate, which is totally annoying to have to, you know, because we only have one little beeper. So the other car.
Right.
You know.
Is there a guard on duty?
24 hours? No, not that rich. No, not yet. Someday. my neighbors, though, one of them, I've only said hi to once, who's working fixing his truck, and he just grunted back at me. So that will probably be the first and final communication.
That's welcome back to California for you.
Well, the other ones are actually great. There is a husband and wife that work from home that were both in the military, met in the military, but now he works in tech. I'm not sure what she does, but they homeschool their kids. They're basically always home.
You should ask them what their feelings on Edward Snowden are.
That was my opening line. That's how I know if my neighbors are cool or not. he works from home and they homeschool their kids. And there's a weird comfort knowing that, like, if we're gone or on vacation or whatever it might be, like, even during work, like, there are people at home. And so, like, I don't know. I guess it gives me comfort that if someone were trying to come and break into our house, that they might actually be there to see or stop them. And plus, they're military, so they definitely carry. So.
Oh, they're ready. Like, they're ready at all times. Oh, they want a reason.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's not a lot of great stand your ground laws in California, but that's not going to stop them.
No, so my wife and I, we manage, we're property managers, and we do it part-time. And we were in an old building in Van Nuys, and we liked it. It was comfortable. It was cozy. But we got an opportunity to actually move into a bigger building with a pool and, more covered parking and all these more amenities. But it's in a nicer neighborhood. So there's like trade-offs basically. When you when you're a property manager in like a neighborhood that's more colorful, like ours used to be, the people there are they're much more appreciative. Okay, they don't expect much. They just want you to, you know, fix a light bulb if it's out, or mop the floor if there's a spill or something. When you move to a nicer area and you're the property manager there, then you get tons of complaints.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it's constant. It's amazing. It's our building is not that super nice or anything by any means, but we've been here a week and we've already heard a ton of complaints already. So
really?
We're expecting it. Yeah, we're expecting more.
Did you consider that going? I wouldn't have thought of that, but did you? I mean,
yeah, I wouldn't have either. But my sister, my brother-in-law also do property management, and they warned us. So their building is really nice, and they told us it gets really bad. You know, the more rent goes up, the more the people expect, which, you know, I understand that. You're paying a lot for rent, especially now in the LA area. So I get it. But it's like, I'm not going to take your trash out for you, lady. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have some sort of serviceman or something?
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's the way some people think here, unfortunately. But, you know, it's part of the job. So
now,
it's fine. It's totally worth it for me.
I was going to say, what you're doing is super smart. Right. So, I mean, like Southern California, not a cheap place to live.
Not at all.
But both you and your wife Sarah have full time jobs. And so you're so part time, you handle these complaints and you get a steep discount on rent to begin with. And then however many hours you work is just more off of that rent. And so, I mean, with the number of complaints coming in, you probably would be paying little to no rent. I mean,
yeah, no. And which is fine, you know, like, as it is, like this building, this I would consider paying the actual monthly fee for rent in this building for a two bedroom.
Your place looks nice
for a two bedroom apartment. I like it. I like it a lot, and I would consider it if I didn't even, you know, if I wasn't even the manager here. So just the fact that we got the opportunity to work out of this building is, I think, we're really fortunate. Even if it's more work, and even if the people aren't as great as the last building, so
yeah.
But I do have to tell you, it's not a gated community, so there are no gates.
No gates.
No.
That's the thing about gates is great. It keeps people out.
I like to think that it keeps people in. So. Yeah.
Also, fewer dead turtles there, I think.
Yeah, no dead turtles. We did do a little shopping this morning, and when we came back, there was a gentleman digging through our dumpster.
Oh.
So that's one thing,
dude,
to
keep
in mind.
Gotta get that gate up, man.
I know. Now I understand the appeal of gates. So.
Well, good, dude. You got a pool. Yeah. You got nice. It looks like you got hardwood floor there or some sort of.
We got hardwood floor.
Yeah, that looks nice. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. And, you know, the invite is open to any brave little listener. If you want to come over,
couch
we have
surfing.
A spare bedroom now. Not even couch surfing. We've got the spare bedroom.
Oh, nice.
So we're good.
Oh, yeah. And before we move on to our topic, can you tell me about this bed you got? Because you sent us a picture of it in the thread, and I don't think I've seen a bed this enormous, maybe in my life.
So we have we've had a queen-size bed for a long time. We've actually had it for like 10 years, and they suggest that you get a new bed every 7 to 10 years, whatever.
Right.
And we were due for a new one. We go to the furniture store, and it just so happened that the bed that we loved was on sale. But it was only on sale in one size, and that size was Eastern King. So we got.
What does that mean? It's different than California King?
It's actually, I guess it's not as wide as a California King.
Oh.
So, and it's a little bit longer, I guess. I don't know. There's like all these distinctions.
So Eastern King, I would like to think, is there some sort of like Eastern, either Eastern or Middle Eastern type of like design?
Well, I wanted the Middle Eastern King, but that was all sold out. Yeah. That one comes with a suicide bomb.
Yes, so okay. I'm like, say it. Say it.
I was like, do I go for it?
Go for it.
No, yeah, so we got this gigantic bed, and it's ridiculous. It's way too big. But, I mean, it was on sale, man. How can you say no?
No,
we need
that's
a new bed
great.
Anyway. So, yeah.
You know,
yeah, so that's part of the fun. Like, we've spent the last, like, 2.5 weeks basically just moving. And we're still not fully unpacked.
Dude, neither are we. I mean, this room, if you want to take a peek, not unpacked. It's just a bunch of stuff. I barely built the desk that this table is sitting on. We've only been here for 3 weeks, and I've already had to fly back to Utah twice for work weeks.
So I thought you were only doing 1 week.
I am. But there was a special circumstance that required me to be there in person 1 week later, after I'd just been there for my, yeah.
So you've done the flight twice.
Yeah.
Have you run into any airline issues?
Yeah, amazingly, already canceled flight. Landing gear broke. Thankfully, before we got on the plane. I didn't know what to do. I could either book a flight the next day or wait around to see if they either fixed it or, you know. And I was asking you guys what I should do, but thankfully they found another plane. That clearly was not a plane that had been used in some time.
Yeah. Were you actually boarded on the plane?
And no,
then
thank
they
goodness.
Found out the, because I was going to say you should have just stayed
no,
on there.
I would have sat. I wouldn't have moved an inch. Like I would have sat like, nope. I watched that United video of that man. Once you're boarded, there's no getting me off this plane.
Oh yeah. He owns a gated community.
Oh, he certainly does.
Yeah.
I want to get that guy a TV show, by the way. Can we get him?
What? Can we get him on Netflix? Why
Netflix
he
should be
Netflix?
Reaching out to him. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That'd be so great. All he has to do is interview people that have had terrible stories on airplanes.
Right. What's that guy's name again? Do you remember his name?
It was David something. I remember his first name was David.
Oh, he's a doctor.
Yeah, no, he was a doctor and a professional poker player. Mm-hmm. And an adulterer.
Who was more of a doctor, that guy or Bill Cosby?
Oh, no. Well, they're both as rich.
Yeah. Well, I was actually going to start this episode with a free Bill Cosby chant, but he's already free.
Can you believe he did that in the video? Can you believe he did that?
I think he's sick. I think he's mentally like losing it because
this is crazy.
First of all, that's the funniest thing he's done in 30 years.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh man, what a creep.
Oh jeez. Yeah, my parents are asking me about that this weekend. Like, do you think he did it? We know he did it.
Oh,
he said he did. And my parents don't. They're not caught up, right? Like, they're
right,
not.
Right,
I don't think they get. They can't differentiate this from a lot of the other like celebrity scandals where people are making accusations. And so, and my dad is such a big Bill Cosby fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, he said it like thinking like, yeah, he probably did. And I was like, no, we know he did. We actually know he did. It's just, is there enough evidence and are the jurors not going to be starstruck to the point that they can actually, you know, convict him?
Oh, they were. They were starstruck.
Oh, super. I mean, all it took was one hey, and they were like, that's
right.
Fat Albert.
Well, I was disappointed that the prosecution didn't call Hannibal Buress onto the stand.
Uh-oh.
You know, he's the one that got this whole thing started.
Yeah, I know.
It's incredible. I mean, because people have been calling Cosby a rapist forever.
Yeah.
It's because it's been known. It's been known that he's done that.
But there hasn't been the onslaught of all the, you know, the women coming forward, right?
It didn't start until Hannibal Buress. And then Buress got the ball rolling.
So what did Buress do exactly?
What he made a joke. I can't remember why he brought up Cosby. But he basically just brought up the fact that it probably had to do something with money or fame or something.
Mm.
And I think that he brought up the fact that everyone knows that Bill Cosby is a rapist, but he's so rich and powerful that it doesn't even matter, essentially.
Yeah, which is like not even a joke. It's just a, you know, it's a sad.
Yeah, no, he's just doing social commentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Which Hannibal Buress is hilarious.
No, yeah,
he is. Super funny.
Well, it's interesting because I've listened to different podcasts and especially a lot of, you know, really successful black comics who have talked about how Bill Cosby has been like a mentor to them personally or has like, you know, tried to help them, you know, on their rise to success and them trying to reconcile the comedian and the help and the guidance and mentorship they received to this man who's done these despicable acts, you know. I mean, even Eddie Murphy wouldn't do the SNL 40 skit, that Celebrity Jeopardy with the Cosby joke. He wouldn't do it because he didn't want to, quote, kick a man while he's down.
You know what's funny about that is when Eddie Murphy was coming up, Bill Cosby attacked him relentlessly because he thought he was too dirty.
Yeah, of course.
he was one of those guys that he attacked him and said, you know, this next generation of comics, no, specifically black comics.
Wow.
All they care about is, like, you know, saying the F word and not eating their Jell-O pudding pops. No, he really did. He attacked them for a long time.
Wow, they must have reconciled at some point.
I guess. Well, you know, it's like when you get to a certain economic status, which they both are, like, you're bros. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like all those pictures of Trump and Bill Clinton hanging out. Like, those guys, I mean, they were best friends.
They were very close.
Yeah.
It's true.
There's so many uncomfortable pictures of them, like, hanging out with just weird...
Could you imagine? Could you be a fly on the wall or a fly on the golf course of those two, and listening to the conversations that they both had about women?
I know.
The things that they had said had to have just been next level awful.
Of course they were. I mean, they really, really, really were bad. All I can think of is that the Roger Ailes documentary. Roger Stone. Rest in peace. Roger Stone is still alive. The documentary where he's walking around with the
I know.
The parody of the Obama Hope shirt, but it's Bill Clinton and it just says rape. Does it say rape or rapist?
No, it says rape.
Yeah, rape.
Which makes less sense than rapist.
Yeah.
But it's funnier.
It's completely inappropriate and very funny.
And that was hard about the Roger Stone documentary is every time I'd see him wearing it, I mean, it's a terrible thing we're talking about.
Oh, I couldn't
help but laugh because of how absurd wearing a shirt like that is.
Right. And Stone is so proud of himself, too. It's just like...
The thing that, you know, we'll be talking in our next episode about Netflix content.
Original program.
One of those being this documentary, Get Me Roger Stone, which I had avoided for a while because I thought it was probably just some sort of, like, you know, really, really, really right-wing, you know, some sort of right-wing documentary. But it wasn't. And when I realized that, I gave it a go. And I don't want to spoil my review of that film, but what I feared came to pass, and that was any level of admiration for Roger Stone and how much he owns up to how terrible he is. And it made him at least semi-endearing. And that completely freaked me out.
So this is the problem with giving people like him a free pass in the press or Richard Spencer, which is just the guy's literally a
Nazi.
Richard
Spencer, terrible.
Right, Roger Stone's not a Nazi, but he's probably just as evil in my eyes.
Sure.
But when you normalize these people that are just against them or should be against them completely, they become, like, I don't know, like, hypnotized by their magnetism or something. But it's like, I don't think it's right to view someone like that as a normal person, because they're not.
I mean, for a lot of reasons. One, he is the weirdest looking person I've ever seen.
Yeah, incredibly odd. Yeah. He has a terrible tattoo of Richard Nixon.
Oh, that's a great tattoo.
He hangs out with Alex Jones. There's just so many problems.
No, it is. Where my admiration and endearing part of it is he allowed, like, a movie crew to follow him around and record him that he absolutely knew had a liberal, left-leaning perspective and agenda. He knew they weren't making something that was going to make him appear flattering, and he was okay with that, embraced it, and gave them full access, which we just don't see that. We don't see that in politics from anyone. I mean, the closest thing, and it's not nowhere near like this, is the Donald Rumsfeld doc, like the Knowing What You, whatever it was called.
Right.
I can't remember the title of it, but your main man, documentarian, Errol Morris,
yeah.
Like,
well, Morris also did the. He talked to the.
The Fog of War.
Yes, Fog of War. With McNamara. That was incredible. That was another incredible.
Yeah, that's even better. Yeah.
And I just think there's danger in it, man.
There's danger in giving them a platform, but also, like, I don't know. It also helped me see. I talk about being endearing to him, and here I am. I'm jumping into a review of it, and I have so many Han Solo hot takes that are just waiting to come out of me right now.
They're coming.
Oh, they are coming, guys. Stick around. Don't fast forward just yet, but please, it's coming soon. What Roger Stone I've also had written off as a kook for appearing on shows like, you know, InfoWars and whatever. But right. what I really didn't realize is the extent at which he has influenced American politics. And it is staggering. The level of influence he's had and for how long he's had it. And so I talk about his personality being, you know, it humanizes him. And that is, you're right, that is not, it is dangerous. But at the same time for me, I also was like, oh, wait, these people aren't just kind of kooks that he may, like, he's done more than just help Donald Trump get elected. This guy has shaped the whole far right wing, you know, strategy of American politics for decades.
He really has. I mean, you want to talk about people that are game changers, influence makers. He's right at the very top. I mean, some people still think that he has influence over Trump. So
yeah, I mean, Trump fired him because he hated the idea that he was getting more, you know, any type of notoriety, right?
Right, and there's talk that he's still influencing.
Totally
Trump,
is. They have phone calls all the time.
Technically, work for him. So, yeah. I mean, if there's one thing that we know about Trump is he relies on those phone calls with his advisors.
Well, it's crazy because we have a president. Not to get too political, here I go. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything. He watches Fox and Friends in the morning, where he gets his news around. He tweets about these issues. When this is the man who has access to all this information, intelligence, and data, and he sees on Fox and Friends things like Obama wiretapped him, so he tweets out how terrible it is that he was wiretapped by Obama. And it's like, he can find out for a fact right now if that happened or not. He can actually find out. But instead, he hears it on Fox on the news like we do, and then tweets it out like it's fact.
Wild.
It's crazy. And so he calls people, like when he fired Comey, he famously called one of the women who were on Fox and Friends, one of those anchors. He called her to ask if it was a good idea, and she told him that it would be a very brave and courageous thing for him to do. and those are the people who are influencing him. Anchors of Fox and right. Friends, Alex Jones, Roger Stone. I mean, this is Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner. Mm-hmm. Jared Kushner, have you ever heard? I've never heard the man say a word. Have you ever heard? Do you know what his voice sounds like?
Well, he just they just released video of him speaking. I think it was on Friday.
Is it doctored? Video?
I think it is. It's actually they use Morgan Freeman's voice on top of it. We actually forgot. You forgot to mention Trump's biggest influencer, Vince McMahon from the WWE.
Are we sure Vince McMahon and Donald Trump aren't the same person? Yeah, Vince McMahon is.
Oh yeah, Vince is in way better shape than Donald.
I would rather have Vince as president.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, he is my president.
Well,
he's
XFL
the president
for
of the WWE.
Life, man, that was so, the league.
Yeah.
Oh jeez. All right. Well, you ready to get into this, man?
Let's do it.
So there was some big Star Wars movie news over the last. I guess it broke about a week ago. Most of you listening probably know this, but right in the middle of principal photography on the new Han Solo standalone film. The directors, Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, were unceremoniously fired by Kathleen Kennedy. And a couple days later announced they were going to be replaced by Ron Howard. Aaron, I don't know where to start.
The very first thing is, could you ever in your wildest dreams imagine a scenario like this happening?
No, actually, I wouldn't.
No way.
If you would have asked me what's the craziest thing that could happen on set, I wouldn't. It wouldn't have gone that far.
There's not a chance. Because what does it tell you about the movie itself when something this catastrophic happens? It's going to suck.
It tells me that
it's going to suck.
There is a 0% chance that the Han Solo standalone Star Wars film will be good.
It's easily going to be, it has the potential to easily be the worst movie that has any association with Star Wars.
And that's, universe. And we have the prequels. We have.
Yeah.
We have the Christmas special.
Well, think about the fact that no one was fired from the prequels, but someone was just fired. The two directors were just fired.
Not even Jar Jar was fired. He was sidelined in episodes 2 and 3.
No, I don't know who came up with Jar Jar, but that man should have been fired.
Oh, yeah, he was. George Lucas.
Yeah.
But no, seriously.
Was it Roger Stone? I think Roger Stone actually pitched the idea of Jar Jar.
So I was at work, I believe, when the news broke, and Beemore actually, he sent a link in our thread.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't. Usually I'm pretty plugged in on Twitter. I have all sorts of news alerts. You know, I'm very, very, I'm too plugged in probably, as my wife tells me. It's like I'm constantly reading news. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly on my phone. It's a problem. But this is one of those times where I wasn't actually paying attention. I was in a big work project and I get this and it ruined my night. I couldn't sleep that night. I'm not joking. I actually couldn't sleep. I was tossing and turning. I was so upset. I had knots in my stomach. And that's because I know that there's a Star Wars film in the pipeline right now that's being made that is going to be very bad. And I know that I'm going to, I mean, the question is how bad will it be? Because we know it won't be good. But let me back up and give you a little bit of context of why this makes me so upset and why I am so concerned. First things first, I still strongly believe that Star Wars as a property is in much better hands with Disney than it ever, than it is with, currently with Lucas, right? Like much, much better. When Disney announced their plans to do these two types of films, the trilogy saga films, as well as the standalones, that to me got me so excited because we were able to continue on the story with the Skywalker family. And then these, the idea of doing a standalone, it, to me, was creatively a brilliant idea because it allows for two things. One, it allows you to explore stories in this massive universe that don't have to be connected to really anything else. And that to me is exciting. But even more exciting is it allows for really interesting filmmakers to come in and make a one-off, interesting, at least stylistically, Star Wars film. And that's it, right? It doesn't have to be connected. Because the only problem with the saga films is you can't really deviate too far. Yeah, I mean, you have this kind of creative sandbox to play in, but it's really pretty limited. You can't get crazy. It's like when Edgar Wright was planning the Ant-Man film before the Marvel Cinematic Universe had really established its tone with the Phase 1 films and then Avengers and then Phase 2. And by the time that this, you know, this long gestating Ant-Man production was ready to begin, you know, finish pre-production, is ready to start filming, they said, no, Edgar Wright, your vision doesn't match with the rest of our movies. And he got kicked off, right? And so, like, that's what sucks is Edgar Wright wasn't interested in making, you know, a sanitized Ant-Man, and they found someone that was able to do it. And it could have been a lot worse than it was, but it was just an okay movie. But in this case, these standalones, it's great. You can get these interesting people. I remember when the news broke, people were throwing all these wild ideas. Now, of course, none of this was like based on news, but just like imagine if Tarantino did a Star Wars film. Like, of course he would never. And he, in fact, he commented saying like, I think it was something to the effect of, why the F would I ever do that? Which is very Tarantino.
And then he said the N-word. He threw the N-word.
There was at least a dozen N-words. like a Wes Anderson, Fincher, even Edgar Wright. You know, like these people that have very distinct visual styles. Like imagine them making a Star Wars film. Like that's exciting. Now, I've said this before on the pod. It's clear that Lucasfilm has this this approach to picking directors where they wanted to pick these kind of up-and-coming indie directors that had one or two successful films under their belt and they're in a way to kind of hedge. They wanted to get people who could make a really, really good movie, but yet they could control if things got out of hand. A big exception to that was J.J. Abrams, who, of course, was much more established, and he was there to kick things off with Force Awakens, and I thought he did an excellent job of doing that in the safest way, you know, possible, of course. But like Gareth Edwards, Rian Johnson, Colin Trevorrow, Josh Trank, and then Phil Lord and Chris Miller. Those are all our directors that have been announced for Star Wars films. That's a really interesting list of names, and they all follow, you know, like Colin Trevorrow did Safety Not Guaranteed, Josh Trank did Chronicle, Rian Johnson had done Brick and Looper, and they got Gareth Edwards who did Monsters and Godzilla. And it's interesting, but it made me nervous. What if they take control back? What if they do? Now, Josh Trank was the first one to go because of issues on the Fantastic Four set. They dropped him and the Boba Fett movie that he was planning. Now, we will likely see that Boba Fett movie at some point in some form or another, but not with Josh Trank at the helm. Colin Trevorrow, you know, he made Jurassic World, which showed that he could handle a big budget film. Now, whether Jurassic World is good or not is another story. I still think it's entertaining, but I'm getting concerned with Colin Trevorrow's Episode 9. I'll get to that in a minute. Rian Johnson right now is making what I think has, you know, the potential to be one of the great Star Wars films, if not the greatest, who knows. But like, I'm really, really, really excited for Episode 8. I think it's going to be something special, and all reports on set indicate that this is one of the most unique Star Wars films, and that is what I like to hear. Now, Phil Lord and Chris Miller, Chris Lord and Phil Miller, I keep, I don't know, I mix up their names. they're exciting because they did 21 and 22 Jump Street, which I think were very funny films. They did the Lego Movie, which also I thought was very, very good. One of Skyler's favorite movies. I think it's his favorite movie. They are known for this kind of improvisational approach to filming, but they're also very, very smart. And I thought, like, a Han Solo film. So I guess I should say that when they announced a Han Solo film, that was a big bummer to me, because the opportunities with these standalones, like Rogue One, I thought was a really, really good story. Now, it's really close to the saga films, but still a good first one-off standalone. A Han Solo origin story is the least interesting idea I could possibly think of for a standalone. Like, you take one of the main characters and give him a backstory that no one has asked for, nobody wants. And so I was really concerned that they were doing a Han Solo film. The only thing that made me excited initially was that they announced that, you know, Chris Lord and Phil Miller were going to do it. So that to me is like, oh, maybe this is going to be good. And then the cast, right? Donald Glover, Alden Ehrenreich, Woody Harrelson, Emilia Clarke. This is going to be good. But it's all about those dudes writing and directing it. And so I was pumped. The very worst thing you could do to that production, in my mind, was to remove them and then put in someone like Ron Howard. Ron Howard.
Yeah, he's, for my money, he's one of the safest, most boring directors currently working in Hollywood right now. So, again, a huge red flag, firing the two incredibly creative younger directors that you took a chance in hiring, and then replacing them with someone who, I mean, he's incredibly cookie cutter, so boring, doesn't take any chances whatsoever. And as far as I'm concerned, he hasn't made a great movie in 15, 16 years. A Beautiful Mind is probably his last best movie.
And even then, it's not
a great movie.
I didn't like it. So Rush is the only, I'm going through his filmography, right? And I need to be clear that I don't think Ron Howard has, never made a good movie, right? I think he's made good movies. What I'm concerned about, the recency of his batting record, it's not great. I'm pulling up IMDb right now to kind of go through that. I mean, he just did these Da Vinci Code films that were so bad, especially the most recent one, Inferno, that just got absolutely annihilated.
It's crazy because they're so terrible. I just don't even understand. You brought up Rush. Rush was okay, but it's not. There's nothing all that interesting about it. You want to talk about an interesting movie about F1 driving? It's the documentary Senna. That is an incredible movie.
That's beautiful.
And so it's like you take that incredible subject matter based off really interesting characters, and then you give us this piece of garbage that Rush was.
Well, wait, did you say Rush?
Yeah, Rush. I just didn't like it whatsoever.
You didn't like Rush?
And I loved... No, man. I was so bored by it. I couldn't believe it.
So I think, yeah, Skyler and I were a little bit higher on Rush. But I'll give you that.
Because you guys are dumb. That's why.
What? You went from the beginning of that being like, it was okay, to just being straight dumb.
And no, I'm enraged now. Like, this is the thing. Like, listening to your passionate plea, I'm actually upset now.
Okay, hear me out. I will say this. I didn't finish Rush thinking, I want that guy to direct a Star Wars film. Okay? I didn't think that. But I think Daniel Brühl and Chris Hemsworth were both really good. If you compare it to Senna, it's going to look... I mean, come on. That's like comparing The Godfather to The Wall with Matt Damon. It's like, well, maybe not.
That's really the only reason I don't like Rush, is because Senna is so much better. Senna is a better movie.
I mean, it's a true story, and it's one of the best documentaries of the last two decades.
Oh, easily. But yeah, let's talk about what Ron Howard's best movies are.
Okay, I will. Recently, it's been not good, and I think this safe... The thing is, the positives of Ron Howard is that he knows how to... to run a film set. Okay, great. He's been in this industry his entire life. Great. He's also super close to Lucasfilm. I mean, he was in American Graffiti, for goodness sakes. Mm-hmm. Like, he is, like, if we want the Han Solo movie to be interesting, we can't afford to have a safe director, because that movie's just at the outset is not a good idea. So let's get something unique and interesting to hopefully make it worth watching. Ron Howard is not going to be the guy to make it worth watching. And Kasdan writing the script is not going to be doing... He's not the guy I want to write an origin story to make it fresh and interesting, put it that way.
Exactly. Fresh is the key for me. Like, that's a perfect word use, because these guys are not fresh.
No.
Kasdan's been writing movies for 50 years.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with experience, okay? But if we want a fresh take on something, you don't bring in a guy who's a lifer, and you don't bring in a director who literally grew up in Hollywood.
Yeah, literally grew up in Hollywood, yeah.
I mean, so it's just so frustrating.
So he's the most recent films, and I'll go through this quickly, because my problem is the films I like of his best are his older stuff, you know, and we'll get into those as I go down this list here. But Inferno was terrible. He directed that Beatles documentary, 8 Days a Week. Safest thing you could do is direct a Beatles documentary, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It was good, but that's because it's the Beatles.
You can't mess it up. Yeah, you cannot screw that up.
Nope. In the Heart of the Sea, very bad. And then I'm skipping some of these documentaries I haven't seen. Rush, I liked more than you. The Dilemma, a comedy with Vince Vaughn, very, very bad. Let's see here. Angels and Demons, very bad. Then we get to Frost Nixon. This is the first one that I put on the same level as Rush. I liked it.
Mm.
Didn't love it. It's not a great movie.
What about that first Da Vinci Code movie?
No, it's terrible. I mean, you wasted a good Paul Bettany performance.
There aren't a lot of those either.
No, there are not. Then you have Cinderella Man. This is going to be controversial. Not a good boxing movie.
It's a terrible boxing movie.
Yes, it is. It is.
I love boxing movies, and Cinderella Man is a terrible one.
You and I love boxing movies so much that we grinded through an entire episode talking about that Miles Teller, Let It Bleed.
Vinny Pazienza? Yeah. Like, what was it? I can't even remember the name of it.
Is that? Yeah. But we were gritting our teeth, giving it a positive review when it was like just a thoroughly mediocre film.
Of course.
But that was still better than Cinderella Man. Cinderella Man.
100%.
Yeah.
It was. I will watch that again before I'll ever watch Cinderella Man.
No, yeah. Cinderella Man is I mean, you got a good Paul Giamatti and that's it.
I'd argue that.
Okay.
I don't even think it was good Paul Giamatti.
It's really, really rough. It's so over the top, sappy, sentimental,
and
which is actually very inaccurate to the true story. Not a good movie. But I know people listening right now are probably getting upset. People love Cinderella Man.
Why?
They love it.
I don't get that.
No, people love it. I've expressed my opinion in the past on Cinderella Man, and people go nuts on me. And so, like, I've had to stop publicly. So I'm really putting myself out there here on this episode, and I'm nervous, but it's okay.
What about The Missing?
I saw The Missing in theaters, and I remember it being very forgettable.
Mm-hmm. So I brought up A Beautiful Mind as one of his better works. Because I mean, it won awards.
Best Picture.
Like at the very least, it won Best Picture, and I think
it's not a bad movie.
No, I mean, for a Ron Howard movie, it's actually really good.
No, it is.
I
would
argue.
Yeah. But again, did you watch A Beautiful Mind and think that guy's got to do a Star Wars movie?
Never.
No,
of course not.
Now, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I famously fell asleep in this one when I was a freshman. It's 2000, so I was in either 8th grade or 9th grade. I fell asleep in the theater at a 10:30 showtime by myself and didn't wake up till 2 a.m. when the janitors had to wake me up. We lived in a hotel right next door because our house had toxic mold. My parents were really upset with me. But, so not a good movie.
So I need to know a little bit of just the backstory on that.
Yeah.
How did they not come looking for you at 2 a.m.?
They didn't know where I was.
Oh, you just went
over. Yeah, so my older brother and sister both worked at the movie theater at the time. It might have been just my little sister at that point. Or my older sister, excuse me. At that point, I had complete free reign to go, because it was directly next door to the hotel that we were living at for 6 months. I could walk into the theater. They all just waved me in. And I just walked in. I saw every movie. That's when I saw The Replacements 7 times. I watched every single movie that came out. And so I was bored one night. I just walked over. It's not like I had to tell my parents where I was going. I was just right next door. And I just sat down at 10:30 showtime and fell asleep. And they were so freaked out.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Of all the movies to fall asleep in, too, that's one of the worst.
Oh, jeez. Jim Carrey. That was the decline of Jim Carrey was really at full. what about Ransom? Mel?
Ransom. Some people like this movie a lot. I don't.
I don't either.
I never liked it.
No.
I watched it once. I've tried to watch it several other times. I couldn't finish it. I just didn't like it.
It's just not that good. Now, next is his best film. Is what I would call his best film. It's Apollo 13.
Easily his best film. You know, I mean, we've all seen it, and we've all seen it multiple times because it's incredibly rewatchable. Super entertaining movie. He got some great performances out of that incredible cast. So if he can go back and find that magic that he found in Apollo 13.
1995.
Exactly. It was 22 years ago that the movie came out. 22 years.
Well, that's what's funny here is getting back, you start to get into this era where he was a little more creatively interesting. I'm like, oh, if we can get that Ron Howard that made Willow and even Splash.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that maybe could be okay. But like that dude is so far away from the guy that directed that film, right? He's just not that person.
No, and that's the interesting thing. Like you brought that up. The latter day Ron Howard movies are just so incredibly safe.
Yeah.
Either and safe, you know what happened?
Safe at best, and then bad at worst, or just very bad at worst.
Consistently safe to bad. And I think if we look at a timeline of when they started getting bad, 9/11 is the common thread.
Oh.
So after 9/11, not only did the country lose its mind, the world, but Ron Howard.
I didn't realize how much 9/11 affected Ron. You're right.
Look at this list.
Oh my gosh, 2001 and beyond. He was done.
So pre 9/11, we have A Beautiful Mind, and then post is when we get The Missing, Cinderella Man, Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, The Dilemma. 9/11 ruined.
I don't know what the total Ron body Howard. Count was and the number of people that lost their lives, 3,000 and something, but we might need to add one more. We lost one more person. That's a...
Oh, Ron Howard's career definitely went down the toilet.
I do have to mention Backdraft as well, which is...
Backdraft is good.
It's good. 1991.
Backdraft is extremely rewatchable.
Yeah.
Cheesy, but yes, you know, it is. It's really good.
And it was a really, really good Universal Studios ride.
Yes.
It's just you walked in and they had this whole set thing when they did Backdraft. I loved that as a kid.
It was super hot in there. Yeah, I remember.
So that dude is directing Han Solo. This is a bad look for Lucasfilm. They want to say that they're open to having these creative minds come in and take a story and go. And the truth of it is, you know, I don't know if it's Kathleen Kennedy. I don't know if it's the entirety of like the Lucasfilm executive team, including the story group. I really don't know who, but they want to keep a lockdown so much so that they really can't actually give that luxury of creative freedom. Now, Rian Johnson has been consistently saying he's had creative freedom. And of course, he's not going to say otherwise, of course. But I tend to believe him based on the stuff that we've seen from the set, even the little bit we've seen in the trailer, and all reports, you know, have been very, very good. But other than that, I just don't think... This is just a really, really bad sign of things to come. And it's bad for the directors now seeing what happened. Now, Josh Trank, maybe he dug his own grave. But the case of Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, and even Gareth Edwards, who there are varying reports about how much the reshoots, you know, he was still involved as a director versus Tony Gilroy. You know, he was obviously a team player, where Chris Lord and Phil Miller were just like, no. They were fired, right? They didn't want to go, but... They were uncompromising.
Exactly. Right.
And
so that's another red flag, right? So we have the reshoots of Rogue One, and then now we have a replacement of an entire directing team. And from what I heard, that there was only about a month left of principal shooting left on Han Solo, which is incredible. That's something like 60 or 70% of the movie's already done.
A lot of the movie has been shot.
Right, and from, I think you linked an article that said they're going to reshoot the entire movie,
basically. The reshoots will become, you know, a redo, really. Like, there will be bits and pieces, right, of stuff that they shot. Some of that will definitely be in there. But this is, now, I am concerned about, obviously, Lucasfilm, what they've done here, especially since I think this idea was bad in the first place. But there have been more reports coming out about that this movie didn't look very good. Right now, of course, these are Lucasfilm. These could be Lucasfilm plants. I don't know. But it's been interesting to read the reports about how zany and improvisational. Essentially, Kasdan wrote a script that people have been talking about as one of the best Star Wars scripts for this movie. Now, that I don't believe. I think that's just a bunch of, you know, that's a bunch of smoke, whatever. But like they've been saying that Kasdan, who's very traditionalist, has gone just he who initially fought to have them as their directors, he really wanted them. He became growing like increasingly concerned when on set they were improvising a bunch of chunks of his script and not doing it verbatim. And of course, old hat Hollywood is not going to love that, right? I mean, he got really upset. But there's so many varying reports about how like it got so zany and weird that it was almost like an Ace Ventura vibe to the comedy. Now, I don't know how true that is. That sounds terrible, right? So there is a chance here, to be clear, there is a chance that they could have been making a bad movie. Yeah, like they could have been doing this that would have felt all wrong. Like I tend to want to trust them and think that, you know, that right. They were going to make something interesting. And I still think that, but I have to entertain the possibility that they were creating something that wasn't going to work. And the fact that I'm hearing Alden Ehrenreich, the guy that's playing Han Solo, is the first one to bring it up to Kathleen Kennedy. Now the tension had been growing between Lawrence Kasdan and Kathleen Kennedy, the directors, for a while. But Alden Ehrenreich was the first one to express his concern that this interpretation of the script was not going well, and he didn't think it was going to be true to the story that Kasdan wrote. So, look, are you buying that at all?
Oh, I do buy it because famously all actors are little bitches. So I completely believe that the star of the movie went behind the back of the director.
It does sound like, oh, dude, it's not a good movie. So. And you and I really like him.
I do. But, I mean, actors suck. Like, that's just the way it is. So my concern is, the biggest concern that I have is if this works, okay, and Ron Howard makes his movie and it makes $1 billion, that's going to then scare Kathleen Kennedy and the rest of the Star Wars brain trust to make the safest possible movies with the most established directors. Like, that is what we want to avoid. And that's what I was hoping they would avoid by hiring all these kind of mavericky directors, auteurs, like in the case of Rian Johnson. But man, if they go back and make this safe movie and it does really well, I think that is a bad
Well, there's
look.
No win here, because if it does well, they'll think, okay, we're gonna pick the Ron Howards for these standalones, right? If it does really poorly, they're gonna chalk it up to they made a mistake getting Phil Lord and Chris Miller at the beginning, and then they had to like kind of cobble something together that didn't really work. But they're not gonna point the blame at Ron Howard.
No. Of course not, yeah.
It's like, I don't want it to bottom out because of that. I also don't want it to succeed. I don't know what. There's just no good scenario here. But
there is no. I'm almost writing this movie off.
Well, I am too. I've said repeatedly I'm not going to see it. Now, we all know that's not true. I will go see it. I know they're going to release a trailer that will be sneaky good. That's the thing we have to realize. They're going to drop the first trailer, and I'm going to come back on this pod. I'm calling my shot right now. I'm going to come back on this pod and make, I don't know, guys. This could actually be really good.
Oh, yeah.
And that's because trailers, you can make the crappiest film look good in a trailer.
Well, I'm concerned because what I've heard is I have a spy on set.
Oh, yeah.
In case you haven't heard. But my spy is telling me that Ron Howard is making a play to get Russell Crowe in as a replacement for Ehrenreich.
Oh, no.
So,
oh, Russell's
you're hearing
young
it here
Solo?
First. Russell is going to play young Han Solo, and they're going to do the digital de-aging
Benjamin
process.
Button.
They're going to Benjamin Button him.
Oh, jeez.
And he's going to play young Han Solo.
Benjamin Button. So, Russell. Oh, my gosh. That's not good.
Keep an eye out for that.
And the reason why this is plausible is because, I mean, this is what they did in Rogue One.
Right, exactly. And so this, now take this one with a grain of salt, because I have a different source that said they're going to, he's trying to get Paul Giamatti to replace Childish Gambino.
Oh, Donald Glover is.
Donald Glover.
Oh my.
He's trying, this is what I've heard. Giamatti and Blackface.
No.
So
no.
It's controversial. But
oh my gosh, we haven't had a Jew in, you know, in any type of black or dark face since Short Circuit. That's not good.
Yeah, that, and that worked.
Did
so
work.
I think that's what they're leaning on that. They're leaning
it's
on
terrible.
That.
That's terrible. But you know what? It. I don't know. I don't know.
I have zero hopes for this movie, man. It's going to suck. Like, let's just be prepared.
Yeah, and I'm prepared for it to suck. It's a bad idea, and now it's got a bad director. It's got a cast I still like, but it's just, at that point, a good cast is only supplemental. It's never, ever, ever in the history of Hollywood has a good cast saved a movie. So.
No. Did the Rogue One script leak before it came out?
No. No, the Force Awakens one did, but no.
Okay.
Not Rogue One.
I was going to say, if Han Solo, the script leaks, then I'll definitely read it. But it doesn't sound like it's going to leak. So.
Honestly, I think Alden Ehrenreich views, especially coming off of the bust he was in, the film directed by the, what's his name, the Hollywood legend that screwed up the announcing of the Best Picture.
Oh, yeah.
Why am I forgetting his
name? Warren Beatty.
Rules don't apply. Yeah. He was just in Warren Beatty's film, Rules Don't Apply, which took like 20 years to make, it feels like. And it was such a bad film that I think Alden Ehrenreich looks at this as like a career defining role. And it's such a difficult, like, I don't envy his job trying to play the most, one of the most iconic, you know, charismatic smugglers. Like, it's like, that's a tough thing to do because it shouldn't be done. And so I think for him, it was probably getting to a point where he thought like he thought his performance and what was going on, the way it was directed, was probably really, really bad. And he probably thought like, uh-oh, I can't afford another bust.
It sounds like there was definitely insecurity there.
Oh, yeah.
So I can get it. I get it.
So I'm concerned. I'd love to hear the brave little takes of our people. I'm ready to move on from talking about it, although in this episode, although we will undoubtedly talk about it in future episodes as more information comes out. But I want to end on a positive note. And that positive note is from maybe our favorite actor right now. I think you and I are, for a lot of reasons we've talked about, are probably higher on this guy than anyone else in the world, and that's Joel Edgerton. And he came out in this little genre horror flick, although after seeing it, I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, a film called It Comes at Night. We talked about the trailer on a previous episode of Brave Little Podcast. You've been very excited to see this film. What did you think?
Just right off the bat, I saw it on Friday night and I loved it. I dug it so very much. It's an unconventional movie that is masqueraded as a very conventional movie. But by the time you get to the end of the journey, you realize that it's something completely different than what you expected going in. So for that fact alone, I absolutely loved it. And I wholly and completely recommend going to see this movie before it leaves theaters, which it's already on its way out. So go check it out as soon as possible.
Yeah, this is not this is an incredibly well told story and an incredible piece of filmmaking. The way that this story unfolds, and I know I've talked about this in other movies and how much I love it, where they just don't like kind of lay out the scenario for you. They kind of put it together piece by piece to where you finally start to get a full picture of what the world in which these people are living in and what's going on. That from the opening scene, which is an incredible thing because you don't fully understand what's going on maybe until 10 minutes in, it just gives this bit by bit that almost is like unsettling because you realize that this kind of post-apocalyptic world that they're living in is pretty terrible, but what's going on? Why is it that way? And why do they just bury this guy? And who is he? And what's the relationship with these people? And are there anyone else out there? And it you know, everyone's asking those questions. And the way it starts to answer them is really brilliant screenwriting. And it's directed in a way that I think it makes it, I don't want to say like edge of your seat, but there's this like very, very building tension.
Yep.
And
throughout the entire thing.
But really the film is never really about... of course, the thing that's out there, whatever that comes out at night, you know, it's a movie about distrust, about human nature, and the relationship between this family and then another family they come across. And I don't want to go into spoilers and go into any more detail than that, but it's brutal. It absolutely holds no punches and is brutal in the way that it, that essentially, predicts how humans would behave in this type of environment.
Yeah, just to set it up real quick, like the premise is that there's some sort of virus outbreak that is affecting the world, and it's kind of like this, it's like a dystopian future kind of thing where there's not necessarily zombies that have taken over, but everyone who gets the virus dies. So Edgerton and his family have to basically hold themselves up in their cabin in the woods to protect themselves from being infected. So that's the premise.
And it's a heck of a little film. I don't know how much money it cost to make. I can't imagine that much.
It hasn't made a lot at the box office, but it's, man, it's so much fun, and it's such a fulfilling. It's an earned victory when you get to the end.
It's a bleak movie.
It's dark. It's bleak, but I felt like it's so honest that it's fine. Yeah. It's, you know.
Yeah, because there was. I was enthralled throughout the whole film. I mean, it's really wonderfully made. And also, I just couldn't help but think about how grateful I am that Joel Edgerton, who could be doing any movie he wants right now.
Oh, yeah.
And he did have a little, I mean, there was like a run there where he did that Ridley Scott, like Moses movie with Christian Bale, where he probably got paid a ton of money. You know, then he was in that Johnny Depp, Whitey Bulger movie. He's getting offered all these types of roles, but he makes It Comes at Night, which there's no way he got paid a lot to do. But he probably read this killer script and thought like, yeah, I'm playing that role. And he was perfect. He was perfect in that role. He's so good.
Man. He's probably my favorite leading man right now, so especially good. If you need someone that's brooding and like kind of a tough guy, the alpha male type. And he was just incredible as the father of this family, man. Oh God, it's so good.
Really good.
Go out and see it if it's playing near you. You're gonna enjoy it. It's a dark movie, but it's fun as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's been interesting to see. It's gotten great reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. It's in the 90%. I don't remember the exact where it landed, but it's in the 90 percentile on Rotten Tomatoes. Now, the cinema score and the audience scores are a little bit lower, just I think because of some of its bleakness. But if you really want a well-told story, a well-acted film, and an incredible piece of filmmaking, go see It Comes at Night. It's a little unsettling, but it's not like a horror film in the sense where you're just getting this like slasher, nonstop gore.
No.
It's not that type of movie.
No, it's not gory at all, but I would definitely say it's a horror film.
Oh yeah, it's a horror film. It's a horror film, but it's not the, in the sense of, I think people think horror film and they think oftentimes these slasher, over-the-top violent films.
And that's kind of how the trailer sold it a little bit.
Sure, they have to, unfortunately.
But it's not. And I think that's one of the reasons that people weren't happy with it, with that cinema, low cinema score, is because they felt like they're going into a slasher kind of 28 Days Later thing. And it's not that. It's not 28
Much
Days
better.
Later. Yeah, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, definitely.
Well, great. That should conclude this episode. Anything else, Aaron?
No, that's it for me.
All right. Thanks, and look out for our next episode where we're gonna review War Machine and rank some of the best Netflix original content. So, with that being said, as we say, hold on to your butts.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.